Welcome to a new episode of the Fit.nl podcast. In this show, we talk to top athletes, scientists, and experts within the field of sports, nutrition, and performance. I'm Jeroen van der Mark, researcher and coach of Fit.nl, and your host for today. Today's guest is Hobi Tam. Hobi is a researcher, entrepreneur, and strength sports enthusiast. Hobi is a system engineer and has transitioned into the field of EMG research. In other words, muscle activation potential, and co-founded the company Aura Muscles. This is a sports performance company based in the Netherlands and the USA, and their company published interesting case studies with top athletes with promising improvements related to strength training insights with EMG data. And today's discussion is super interesting because EMG research is gaining more and more traction in the last few years. So we're going to talk about that and what are the pros and cons of this new research tool. And we ask ourselves the question, is EMG research the future for more gains and more individualized training? Before we start the show, a short disclaimer. This is not medical advice and it's based on our personal opinions from evidence gathered thus far. A lot of this discussion must still be validated. We have so much work to do, but this is what we know so far and is the tip of the sword when it comes to performance insights using EMG. Enough introduction, let's start. Hobi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jeroen.
Yeah, this is going to be interesting. You have your own EMG measuring company. So today is all about EMG data measuring and muscle activation. First of all, to really go in depth, I want to talk about a case study you guys did in the Netherlands with the ice skating team, WorldStream. And I think it's good to start out with this study, this case study, to get a better picture of what EMG does and how it can be practical to use for sports performance. Can you tell me anything about the improvement in performance and how you guys used it?
Yeah, that study was a very interesting case study. The head coach was really wondering what movements are really specific to speed skating. And so what we did was we actually, instead of using just visual cues, so right now, coaches and trainers, they say that one movement is like another movement just based on what they see. However, what we found by measuring actual muscle excitation patterns using our EMG system was that this is actually, that assumption might be flawed, in that we found that barbell squats may not be very specific to speed skating. But intuitively, you know, it's like speed skating, it uses your legs. What builds legs? Squats. But we found that perhaps maybe that's not the best tool to use during a peaking cycle when you want to maximize specificity. And we found, among other things, a lot of different findings from this. And we ended up concluding that, hey, 30, 40% of the weight room time that these speed skaters, these elite athletes are using, might not be optimally spent. You know, if you're doing non-specific training during your peaking cycle, it might actually make more sense to just recover during that time. Or if you can substitute out those movements, maybe use those non-specific movements in a more off-season or pre-season building block. But when you start to peak for competition, maybe exchanging those movements out with more sport-specific movements that we found from the muscle perspective.
You know, super interesting.
Yeah, super interesting. Yeah,
to interrupt, so you guys... So at first they had like a lot of training volume for squats, and ice skating is also like kind of hip dominant. So what I know from, I've read a little bit and I talked to you, is like you removed a little bit of squats and you put like more hip thrust in, and that changed actually the performance.
Yeah. What we did was we tested their entire workout and we selected, hey, these movements really look like speed skating, and it was more power movements. And so we substituted those in, and the coach was like, okay, if this really works, the proof is in the pudding. And so what he did was he created a 6-week program that cut all squatting out and kept barbell, like heavy barbell on your back movements, very minimal, and exchanged it out for more hip kind of power movements. And not only did they not see a deterioration in speed, so they eliminated a very high risk exercise from right around competition. They actually noticed in the speed skater that we tested on, he was able to skate one of his best times during training. And so, and he was recovering from injury from actually doing heavy barbell squats. And so this really interested the coach, and we did 8 more months of testing with them where they essentially did this with the whole team, and we monitored technique in preparation for the Olympic cycle.
Whoa. So what you guys did, you measured EMG activity while skating, and then you found out actually that's the, for example, the hip movement is also important, not only, for example, the knee extensors, the quads, and then you changed the whole training schedule.
Yeah, our data was used. You know, we're not trying to coach. We're actually trying to enable a coach to do their job even better, to produce the best athletes. So what the coach, we just provide reports and analytics of exactly what the coach wants to know to validate their assumptions. Are these movements the best use of my time at this point in my training cycle? And we enable the coach to make those training decisions and not have to constantly look back, and they can validate their assumptions. That's what we found is our best value, is to enable the coach to be in the best position to succeed.
Yeah. Can you share one more of this, like EMG orientated strength and conditioning finding you found?
Yeah. What's a good one? One good case study that we found was actually working with Mike Teixeira. So Mike T, as a lot of your listeners probably know, his goal in life is to bench a Buick, which is, for the international listeners, that's a car in the US. And you know, he's a big dude and he's pretty close, but you know, you're never as big as your pump, right? So he wants to bench more. And what we said was, Hey Mike, we have this new sensor system, and we think that we can start to validate things that you're doing. And, you know, he's a very RPE, very empirical based person. You know, this is a guy that tested the pH of his urine for a couple months just to find out, just to confirm that it did not correlate with fatigue. Okay. So I was like, okay, this guy's the best person to test the sensor system with, because he'll want to collect data. And so what we set out asking was, it was very exploratory at first. It's like, what movements actually look like bench? And we specifically focused on his triceps, because he knows that when he builds more triceps, his bench usually goes up. And so we were measuring his tricep, and from the triceps perspective, what is specific? And then it turned into, well, if we can measure intensity, or we can measure something about how hard his tricep is working, can we equate that to RPE, or how well does it correlate to RPE? And it turned out that it does correlate very well. And it actually allows him to validate some assumptions when he makes programming decisions, like especially with his emerging strategies. You know, he has to validate a lot of assumptions because he likes to ride the wave of training stimuli. But at the same time, he also said, hey, this might be useful to be, if we could distill this down to a product for coaches that want to be more empirical and objective driven and like using data to program. He said that, hey, maybe this can be used in a diagnostic protocol where you spend 2 weeks or 1 week just measuring various lifts and looking at how range of motion and load affect the training stimulus to a lifter's muscle, and you can better calibrate programs for your specific lifters instead of going through this trial by fire process where you kind of try stuff and it's this iterative design process for 3 to 6 months just to understand how your lifter lifts. Can we speed up that time and make adjustments faster? Because, you know, a lot of people want gains fast, and why not lift more efficiently and try to avoid injuries doing that?
Yeah. Did he get some new insights, for example, from assistance lifts or like kind of isolation exercises that helped him for his bench by using the EMG data?
Man, there's a lot that we discovered from using that EMG data. But I think the biggest nugget of knowledge was that It wasn't actually a specific movement where we were looking for. Like, obviously, if you do board presses versus full bench press, JM presses, banded assists, these all produce different muscle patternings. So you can almost create a toolbox to try to customize a training stimulus for whatever goals that you have. But I think the biggest thing that we figured out how to do was to, I guess, the one big thing with RPE is if I do an AMRAP, like let's say I do a 10 rep max set, that is RPE 10. But if I also move up to a single rep max, that is also RPE 10. So the RPE system right now doesn't parse fatigue versus intensity that well. And what we could do with the EMG data is to start parsing that out. And what bro science culture, and it's starting to leak into the real literature, is there's this idea of CNS fatigue, central nervous system fatigue, versus peripheral fatigue. So like, let's say you do some deadlifts and then you just like the next week, you just kind of feel really sluggish. That's like CNS fatigue.
Yeah.
And then like acute muscle soreness. Yeah. Is like peripheral stress. And so what we know is that high volume training produces more soreness and peripheral stress. And usually like those intense workouts where you're hitting those 5, 3, 1 rep maxes will produce CNS fatigue. And so what the sensor system was actually able to parse that out by extracting some features, some things from the signal that we're getting to actually say, okay, how much we can talk about work capacity, work duration, and intensity a little bit more fine resolution to try and program better.
So you would see like a relationship between, for example, high intensity with a high load, for example, 1 to 3 reps, that the muscle excitation, so the EMG activation data, was way higher compared to a 10 rep, or there you see different signals.
We would see different signals. It's not guaranteed. Sometimes, you know, in those 10 rep, in those volume repetitions, sometimes, you know, we find out that each rep is almost different. In a very consistent lifter like Mike T, those reps are going to be very consistent. But we've tested other lifters that are usually untrained lifters. It's very variable how like one squat is good, the next squat isn't as good, but then they get it together the next squat. So we can start to parse a lot of these things out, you know, and in the signal, you can actually get consistency of technique, and you can also start to see compensation mechanisms in the data.
Yeah, yeah. I would totally agree that, for example, a lifter like Mike Teixeira has like a bar pad that's kind of similar every rep compared to a beginner lifter. But we can discuss that later because we also did a study on that together. So that's super interesting. So we talked a lot about EMG, but like first we try to explain what it actually measures and if there's a direct relationship with like hypertrophy.
Yeah. I think that we still have to do a lot more testing before we start to say, hey, if you train like this, it's going to be hypertrophy. If you're going to train like this, you're going to go maximal strength. For us, our mission is to tell you what does the training stimulus look like. And then as a coach, you can figure out, okay, this is the volume that I think will produce hypertrophy, or this is the volume or load or intensity that's going to produce maximal strength, or you can produce a hybrid athlete. But specifically what we have found is that something happens when you start to approach the 1 rep max. So what we found is that the muscle exerts exponential. It's like an exponential ramp up when you start to look at, like if you start doing singles all the way up to your 1 rep max, or triples all the way up to your 1 rep max, it's an actual exponential relationship if we look at how the muscle starts to get more work done. So we do believe that there's this cutoff where there is like a training stimulus for between hypertrophy and maximal strength. However, it's likely different for most athletes. And to kind of draw the line, we would need to test that athlete.
Yeah, that's super interesting. That's already like practical, but like first, let's try to explain what EMG actually does and what are the pros and cons. So your brain gives a signal to the muscle, and then you measure actually that signal. So it's not so much the contraction of the muscle that you're measuring, but the electrical signal. Can you explain how EMG works?
Yeah, so exactly like you said, when you think about movement, the signal originates in the brain, and then it's an electrical signal conducted through neurons throughout our body. And eventually that electrical signal ends up in our muscles. And then once the electrical signal reaches our muscles, then it begins an excitation, essentially a preset protocol. And then that controls muscle contractions. Now, because it's an electrical signal, we have ways to measure electrical signals. And this electrical signal conducts through the muscle architecture, soft tissue, and the skin of our body. And so what we can do is we can put surface electrodes onto our skin, much like if you were just looking at an electrical circuit and you want to find the voltage difference between two points on a wire. We do that with our muscle. Very similar technology, but obviously, because it has to go through.
But it's not strong enough to light a bulb, right?
No, unless maybe
it's really minimal.
Maybe if you're Mike Tashier and you flex really hard for a long time, you could probably run a floodlight. But most of us will not be able to generate that. It's on the really small scale millivolts. But essentially, we just sense that voltage difference. But there's a lot of noise in that signal because it has to go through so much soft tissue, muscle architecture, and the skin. And there's different factors that can affect the signal quality. We try to produce the best signal quality to get the best data to analyze, but there's a lot of data analysis that has to go into conditioning and processing that signal and then normalizing that signal so you can start comparing apples to apples.
So would you say you have a valid instrument now? With like valid data, like with all the EMG data that you're collecting?
From just the device perspective, the verification and validation, this is a clinical grade sensor. We're the manufacturer that we use is seeking medical clearance right now. It's in the middle of clinical trials. They use it to monitor breathing. And then we got the license to use it for skeletal muscles and rehabilitation and like all these other use cases. And so it is a medical grade product and it has been validated a lot of data in breathing, but also we're doing, a lot of pilot site work to validate that. Okay. When we use this sensor on these muscles in these movements, these are the patterns that we see. And then, we're doing a lot of the validation work to get that data to essentially say, okay, this muscle excitation is correlated with this muscle behavior.
Good to know that this way of measuring muscle excitation has been validated more and more over the last few years. One more question that relates to this topic. Is there a difference if you measure EMG with needles compared to using the pads?
Yeah, so the fine needles, and so those are also called subcutaneous needles. They got a lot of different names in the literature. Those are probably likely more accurate because you're going straight into the muscle. And you're not having to deal with all the noise that the signal has to travel through in just something that we're taking off of the surface. However, obviously sticking needles inside of you while you're trying to work out is not too practical. And so the question becomes, are the surface electrodes good enough to be used practically? And essentially, again, we're doing a lot of testing in pilot sites and really validating that these signals really do correlate with the phenomena that we're trying to observe and trying to make predictions off of. And so thus far for, you know, a lot of weightlifting movements, so we've validated at weightlifting, powerlifting, and then and some other like hybrid sports and endurance sports sites, this data does correlate very closely with outcomes in terms of what we see in performance and movement. So, the question, you know, if you ask an engineer if it's good enough, they always say it depends. And different. So I think it's use case by use case.
That's super interesting. I think a lot of coaches nowadays and people in the industry, they cite studies with EMG. Oh, this muscle has more EMG activation, so it's better. Is there, like, how direct is the relationship between muscle excitation measurement, EMG, related to muscle hypertrophy?
Yeah, I don't think... I'm going to side with Andrew Vygotsky on this one. I don't think that we can really correlate the two. All the EMG the signal tells you is, okay, this is the, I'm not sure, I'm not like a EMG researcher or clinician, but essentially the neural input doesn't really, it's not 100% guaranteed with the work output. What you should look at is when I do a hypertrophy workout. So let's say you do a high volume workout. This is what my signal usually looks like. And then you measure that multiple times to validate, okay, this is really what happens. And then you compare that to a maximal strength workout. And then you can start to correlate, okay, when the training loads are like this, this is what happens with my muscle. When the training loads are like this, this is what happens to my muscles. And then you correlate those with performance gains. And then with... this is where the sensor system comes in. That data is key, is that you can actually track that load and try to manipulate the variables at a much more higher resolution. For example, if you're using RPE, the error margin on that may be high or low. It's based on your bias and subjectivity. And what happens if you're not doing powerlifting movements where Mike Teixeira is kind of like optimized the RPE scale for that, to that use case. If you're doing, jump training, if you're doing a lot of barbell movements, if you're running on a track and you're doing a sprint, how do you really understand intensity? How do you really understand specificity? Those are the two things that we can't, there's not a lot of tools to measure that right now empirically. And so this is another tool to try and lower that error range. And so you can start to program a little bit better with kind of like a formula where you have all these training stimuli and you can start to optimize these training stimuli instead of just trying to, okay, we're going to try this block. And then you try it for 4 weeks and then it's like, okay, let's make adjustment. You know, it takes 6-8 months to really optimize that. Whereas, could you use EMG to help select better movements and validate a lot of those assumptions and get that optimization time down?
Yeah, super interesting. I think velocity-based training, bar pad, EMG data, RPE, I think that's like objective and subjective measurements in once. I think that's like the future of lifting. If you really want to be a high performer and really want to improve, you need like you need this kind of data. So that's kind of the future. Do you see like a lot of athletes or maybe even like commercial gyms with like consumers in the future with EMG pads on working in a gym?
Yeah, that's a tough question. It comes down to workflow integration. How much does the average person want to work for gains, right? I think that if Oral Muscles was able to create a seamless package that a gym could purchase and then essentially amortize.
Like a suit or something, an EMG suit.
Yeah, or like a sleeve or something that could be easily put on, takes like 30 seconds to set up. And essentially it's as easy as using a smartwatch, but it's essentially recording how hard you're working for each particular muscle group. And then it can calibrate and essentially give you a criteria to say, hey, this was your training stress today. And then track that training stress over time. And then also track the performance gains. And so you can start to see, okay, I can ramp up my training stress like this. And then I get these performance gains. Can I ramp up more? Should I ramp up less? Can I predict deloads and tapers when needed? Can I avoid injury? You know, when I work out a lot, when the training load is a lot and I'm getting ready to compete, I usually get sick. Yeah. And so can we also tell if the progressive overload is too overloaded?
Yeah. And would you assume that, for example, the EMG activation is less when you're, for example, overtrained?
Yeah, this is a very interesting question. And so we've done a lot of AMRAP testing, so as many reps as possible. And what happens is, so we like to track movement efficiency. And what we've noticed is that as someone approaches a max, their movement actually gets more inefficient, which means that they tend to try to invest more from the neural input side, but the outcome goes down. So what I would expect when someone is overtrained or someone's overloaded or starting to fatigue is that there will actually be larger EMG, like the amplitude of the signal will go up, but the performance actually goes down. So instead of having a car that takes a little bit of gas to go a long way, the inefficient car is going to take a lot of gas to go much shorter distance. And that's kind of what we've seen with AMRAPs. We've also seen this in an ACL reconstruction study that we did in the injured leg. The muscle activation or the muscle excitation, the amplitude was actually higher than the healthy leg. However, the injured leg was 30-40% less strong. It was 30-40% weaker. And that was right, like the 3 to 5 month period after an ACL reconstruction. But then if you zoom out to 9 to 12 months, when it's fully healed, the amplitude is about the same. We also look at other features like area underneath the curve. You know, this is starting to get a little technical, but all the metrics associated with muscle activation or muscle excitation, they start to kind of level out and look like the healthy leg. But in the beginning of rehab, it's actually elevated muscle activity or indicators of muscle activity.
Yeah. Just to summarize it, so actually when you're injured, your brain actually gives more like horsepower, more like electrical signals to the muscle, maybe to compensate. That's super interesting insight.
Yeah, it is a compensation mechanism. And yeah, more research needs to be done to see if, you know, is there more neural drive? Is there something going on in the muscle? Is that, you know, that's a lot of basic science to be done, but we've measured this phenomena in a lot of different use cases. So, you know, maybe we just got lucky a lot of times, but in my experience, I think this is a nice intuitive, it's not too big of an intuitive leap to start modeling muscles almost like engines in cars from that perspective where we look at efficiency.
So we also did a squat studies together where we like differentiated between beginning athletes and advanced athletes, people like over 130% of their body weight squat. So we looked at like front squat and back squat and also the EMG data and the difference between four muscles. And actually one of the surprising things is that beginner athletes activate their muscles quite the same, not statistically differently, than advanced athletes. So there's something kind of work capacity related. It's not so much that they, like, for example, a beginner doesn't fire their glutes, for example, in the squat. They actually use their glute relatively the same as an advanced athlete. Was this surprising to you?
Yes and no, right? I think intuitively, you would think that more trained athletes know how to quote unquote activate their muscles better. But what does that really mean? I think that trained athletes probably have more work capacity capabilities inside their muscles, and they've developed how to use their muscles in the right way. And to kind of rephrase that, untrained athletes or beginner lifters, it seems that like they're trying as hard as they can. You know, it's not when you put a load on them, you know, when they're doing the earthquake reps, even though it's not a lot of weight, you can tell that they're working really hard, right? So I think it is, I think it is a, it's kind of a misnomer to say that, oh, you're not activating or you're not using these muscle groups. I think that they're actually using those muscle groups as much as they think they can, or, you know, they think that you have to squat this way.
Yeah. Here's a big if. So what actually, and this comes true to the basics, actually what we started out the conversation with, we measured their muscle excitation. So we didn't measure their contraction. So there's the difference between the contraction elements, and there can be actually an activation difference between beginner athletes and advanced athletes. If we look at primary EMG data, we only see like the electrical signal between the beginner and advanced athletes at those different body parts, muscles, are not so different.
Yeah. And so there might be something at the muscle level going on. However, it's also demonstrating the difference between a untrained lifter and a much more trained lifter, in that somehow the trained lifter is somehow using that neural input to produce much more output. And it kind of talks to what you were talking about, is work capacity. So if we model, let's say, like, again, if you look at each muscle as like an engine, and each engine has 0 to 100% capacity, that scale is pretty much the same for each lifter, 0 to 100%. But that 0 to 100%, the outcome from that is much different the more you're trained. So like a 30% for, if you're operating at 30% for a trained lifter, that might be already 100% for an untrained lifter in terms of work capacity or the load that they're able to move.
So it's like how big the car is, actually.
Yeah, how big the car is, how conditioned it is. Yeah, like how much work did you do to the engine, you know?
But the one also thing that I found pretty interesting is like the difference between front and back squat. That's not such a big difference between muscle activation between all the different muscles. That's an interesting insight. What are the insights, what you find about the squat study we did?
Yeah, I think the number one insight was it validated the value of just spending all these hours lifting, is that, hey, if you train, your work capacity goes up so much and the efficiency goes up so much. For instance, in that study, when lifters were approaching their 70% 3-rep max back squat, the trained lifters were, that's when their engine started really shifting gears. However, in an untrained lifter, you know, down by when they were approaching maybe their 30, 50% 3-rep max, they were already like, okay, this is hard work. So relatively speaking, that was a very interesting finding. And we also found that, again, the muscle, just muscle activity, I know that's really bad, that's bad nomenclature, but the muscle behavior is exponential as we start to approach maximal strength loads. So it takes a lot more load, relative load even, for a trained lifter, like a very experienced lifter, to actually get gains, to start to get that exponent, get on the other side of that exponential curve. But for a beginner lifter, doesn't take much.
Yeah, this is like a direct measurement. Of course, you have to study this on long term. I think that's also the interesting perspective, like short term measurements, with like muscle excitation instead of like long-term hypertrophy. We need a lot of studies like this. This is one of the questions I have for in the future. Are there any questions you have related to EMG that's interesting for the listener that we didn't spoke about?
Yeah, I think, again, I would like to test more people. But from our perspective, again, I'm going to stick with this kind of engine muscle analogy, in that if we model muscles almost like engines, it seems that, you know, if you look at, there's a lot of different types of cars, right? But more or less, cars take energy and they convert that into some work output to travel. So in that sense, you know, there's a lot of different muscles out there. Like my muscles are different from your muscles, but at the end of the day, I think about, okay, I want to do this movement, and then I convert that electrical signal into some work capacity. So in that sense, and there's a sliding scale. Like I can lift my arm to eat versus I can bicep curl at the max load possible, right? Yeah. So there's this sliding scale where we can activate muscles like this. But that's as similar as you and I are, right? Your muscle architecture from whatever stress and training you put your body through, your muscle architecture is going to adapt to that. Same thing with me. And so how we reach that point is really different. And I think that's the most interesting thing about EMG. And I think that's why, like I tried a lot of squat programs when like my squat would just not go up. So I was a very non-responsive person to a lot of squat programs. And so I had to try a lot of different squat programs until I found one that actually produced gains for me. And I think this is kind of the underlying reason, is that we have to do more testing. And this is where the EMG tool comes into really good use, is that you can start to customize, like very quickly find out, okay, what are you most responsive to? How does your muscle really behave? And what muscle patternings are happening? And so I do think that getting back to your original question, what am I still wondering about? How do different people's muscles respond to training? I think that is the biggest question, remaining in the field of anything to do with fitness. And I think EMG may be a powerful tool to help us answer this. And maybe another tool comes along, and I'm more than willing to try and switch if that's possible, you know, because we're all about finding the best tools to enable coaches to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What we did in our study was we actually also measured bar pad, and we compared actually, for example, if somebody is compensating more, do you actually also see that? Is the muscle differently activating? So that's like all these insights are super interesting. For example, strength and conditioning coaches, or they want to start out a pilot site, how can they contact you guys?
First, you can check out our Instagram page, and you can check out some, we post little videos of us, you know, of us testing. And then we also kind of put case reports on there. However, we're relaunching our website this week. Yeah. So it's August 5th right now. But next week, our new website will be relaunched, oralmuscles.com. And we'll have a validation page where you can look at case reports that we've done and see if, hey, that sounds like kind of what I'm doing. And there's a contact us, send us an email, and we'll get you set up as a pilot site. We're actively onboarding right now.
Can't wait to do another case study together. Super interesting.
100%.
You also did medical research. Can you tell us something about that? Like it's not only sport performance.
Yeah, so we partnered with the University of Groningen and with their human movement science lab with Dr. Ua Hymans and Dr. Christian Grief. And we were looking at a pathological gait. So these patients had a neurological lesion growing on a nerve, and it caused them to have severely walk. Their walking was severely impaired. And this makes partitioning and looking at their steps kind of difficult. A clinician has to go in and physically label all these, and the way their laboratory, it's this giant laboratory that is very expensive and there's a lot of equipment inside. but all that equipment has different data formats, so it's all over the place. So it takes a while for the clinician to actually partition the data. And what we did for them was, hey, what if we just used our sensor and our AI? So we use artificial intelligence to actually speed up a mm-hmm. lot of the analytics. And that's actually the real value of Aura Muscles when you look at the technical perspective, is that I mentioned that there's a lot of data processing analytics and mm-hmm. Before you can really start to make insights, we were able to automate all that. And so we're creating a seamless user experience. So you don't need to be a signals analysis expert. You don't need to be an EMG expert. You can just be a coach, and then you just collect the data and use our AI engine to give you a diagnostic report. And we essentially use the same thing for pathological gait partition. And we were able to prove in the study that we can use motion capture data as well as IMU data to partition a patient's gait. And it was as accurate as the clinician watching slow motion footage marking where the patient stepped. And so, you know, we're putting together another study because that we put our IMU EMG sensor on that patient. And so we're also looking at, okay, now that we can classify, okay, this is where the patient had foot drop or foot drag, or they contacted with their forefoot, all these indicators mm-hmm. of pathological gait. Okay, we can detect what happened. Now we can start to look at, okay, why did that happen? And what we found was, okay, there's abnormal behaviors in the calf muscle. And it's like night and day what is happening when the foot is swinging versus on stance, from a normal step versus a pathological step. And you can tell that all from the EMG data.
Ah, I get it. So there's a difference in gait, and maybe because somebody fires their calf muscles differently than somebody that has a normal gait.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And this is just an example use case, but we found that, okay, we can use this as a screening tool for abnormal muscle activity. And this is huge insight, because do we need to fix this with pharmaceuticals? You know, is it a periodic thing that happens? And it's there's something with a neurotransmitter, or is there muscle atrophy? And we need to solve this problem with physiotherapy, where we need to produce more, we need to grow the muscle so this doesn't happen. But you know, you can envision this being applied to other medical use cases, where there's some 100%. Type of abnormal musculoskeletal movement, and it's a lot easier to actually do this analysis on patients rather than athletes, because in patients it's so the contrast is so
there's a bigger
much.
Difference
there's a huge difference, whereas athletes you're looking at minute deviations. We're essentially using this for the elite athletics space. We're going to focus on that because it's an easier market to penetrate. There's a lot of traction in that market. However, the same platform, our AI engine, as well as our sensors, you know, they're actually rooted in medical grade technology. And so we do hope to transition one day, but our focus is on these elite athletes, and we're keeping the medical use cases as some sticks in the fire, but obviously very long commercialization journey for that.
Yeah, super interesting. Before we round up with your favorite podcast book and in training insight, did we miss anything important you want to talk about like Aura Muscles or EMG that should be important for our listeners?
I think, you know, I come from a wrestling and weightlifting background, and my co-founder, she also comes from an athletic background. And how Aura Muscles originally started was, you know, we were just some dudes sitting on a couch watching sports, and then one of our favorite athletes gets injured. No one touched him. And it's like, you know, should that happen? And that's what, you know, bought a case of beer, and then we did what engineers do best. We made a prototype. And so that's actually how kind of Oral Muscle started, was just some dudes drinking beer in a living room. The idea was, can we use off-the-shelf sensors to predict or at least determine deviations in movement? Made this horrible prototype, but it worked. And over the next several years, we've been able to refine this prototype down to what looks like a flash drive. That's how big the sensor is. And you literally, it takes 90 seconds to strap on and start collecting data. And so it's come a long way. It's been very user patient driven, the design. We're really sensor agnostic. We're not married to any type of technology. We're very customer focused in that. And so, you know, we're athletes ourselves, and obviously we've had loved ones. We've experienced dementia, Parkinson's, and all these movement disorders in our own families. And we come from a biomedical engineering background. So we're very user focused. And I think that's the number one, like, that's why all this began, is that vision and that background to even have oral muscles exist in the first place.
Yeah. Make bodies move better.
Yeah.
And let muscles activate like in the right way. Super interesting. Hope we get more insight in EMG data in the future. I think it's going to be the next big thing in strength and conditioning, combined with more velocity-based training. Actually, to round up, can you tell me anything about, like, you ask every podcast guest their favorite book and podcast. What's your favorite podcast at the moment?
Favorite podcast has to be Lex Friedman. He has a lot of people with a lot of deep insights, and especially because we're building an AI platform, and he has a lot of product development people on his podcast, but also a decent amount of athletes. I religiously listen to Lex Friedman.
Nice. And if you have to give me or the listener or a loved one a book, which book is that and why?
I'm reading a really good book right now. It's called Build. It's by Tony Fadell, the guy who was in charge of making the iPod, iPhone, and Google Nest. It's a really good book. The whole title is a practical, an unorthodox way method to make practical things, something like that. But it's essentially, he talks about his experience and how there are many stepping stones that are not in the media, where he failed a lot to put him in a position to be able to make all these very disruptive products that, you know, are affecting you and me and probably a lot of your listeners right now. But it all came from one person, but working on a team. And he talks about how he had to experience a lot of failure to reach that.
Yeah. I think that's super important, because I think when people hear that, they think, oh, he just got it right away. He just built an iPod.
Exactly.
I think there's like so much prototypes and so much iterations and mistakes they made. So even with 100%. The podcast, when I'm recording now, I think, oh, I can ask this question differently. Oh, I misspoke because I'm not a native English speaker. But it's like already the process. I'm enjoying the process. So I think that's really cool. So I'm reading, I'm going to read Bold By Tony Fadell, everything what we just discussed, and all the scientific papers we put in the show notes. So for our listeners that wanted to know. Great book tip. If you can give one single training tip to our listeners, what would that be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And being a gym bro myself, I would say just learn to enjoy lifting. Like, I know that I run a data analytics company. I want people to be more data driven. I want you to record your RP, use velocity based training, use one of our systems. But at the end of the day, again, what is going to put you in the best possible position to succeed? And I think more importantly, what I think everybody's ultimate goal is to just feel fulfilled and be content in life. And so learn to love lifting and make a way to to love lifting or training in general. I think that you're going to find a lot more fulfillment and contentment in your life if you figure out a way to say, oh, I get to train today, not, oh, I have to train today. And so, I think that, you know, learn to love the grind and understand that, you know, Mike T, a lot of these huge dudes and a lot of women are stronger than me now, on Instagram. They didn't get that way. Like they weren't just born that way. Right. Everybody had to work for that. And so you get there by learning to love it.
I think that's really great to wrap up. I can relate so much. I think the only people that survive, maybe it's survivor bias, but that are the people actually that really enjoy the process. Enjoy and like people that are like outcome orientated, like maybe also body orientated. I want to look like this, and they don't enjoy lifting themselves or how to improve actually the process of being a better lifter. You see such a big difference in outcome if you look at 5 or 10 years. Most of them stop after 1 or 2 years.
100%. I think Ronnie Coleman said it the best when I think of like who epitomizes loving lifting. I think of Ronnie Coleman, you know, yeah, buddy, lightweight.
yeah, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. But also, you know, I was listening to him on the Joe Rogan podcast and he was in crutches, a wheelchair. He's had so many back surgeries. He's better now. He's in a better position now, but he was like pretty much crippled because of all those years of just putting his body into the ground for bodybuilding. And, you know, Joe Rogan asked him, hey, do you regret any of it? He's like, yeah, I should have trained more. And, you know, like it takes, and I was talking to Tim Mercer from Redbeard Barbell. I'll shout him out because he said something, he said something really profound. He said, there's got to be, it's demented what we do. We go into the gym every day and we kill ourselves and there's no, like very few people are making money from this. So it's literally just for some reason, we like putting ourselves through this day in, day out, every day for decades, even years and decades. So the only conclusion is we find some fulfillment and contentment in it. So figure that out. And I think, learn to love the journey because then no matter what you're going to gain.
I think that's a great summary of the whole conversation. Hobie, thanks a lot for explaining how we can use EMG. And for people, please contact if you want to start a pilot site or start actually with EMG measurement. Thanks a lot for today explaining, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode. All the links to the case studies, the scientific studies we discussed, and the link to Aura Muscle can be found in the description. And did you find this episode valuable? Then you can support us via a number of ways. Give a review in the Spotify app or share a review. Let us know what you think of the show via iTunes with a text. It helps us a lot and boosts the show. And finally, share the episode with friends, family, or via social media. Tag fit_NL and oro.muscles. This helps us a lot. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you in the next episode.